We can keep this up as long as you can, Nicolas Cage. On this episode, we discuss Trespass. Everyone, and welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Elliot Kalin.
And I'm Zubin Parang.
That's right. Stuart is visiting
his family.
His family in Fort Wayne for a late Christmas, as I understand it.
Well, since, as we established in the last episode, he worships Crom, Cromian Christmas is actually in late January.
Oh, that's Cromian Reform Christmas.
Yeah, Orthodox Crom Christmas is December 25th.
But Zubin is one of our co-workers. At The Daily Show.
A writer at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. What is that exactly?
It is a topical comedy show that makes light of the foibles of modern-day politicians and the media that covers them. It's a great show.
I'm sleeping already.
I encourage you guys to check it out. It's funnier than it sounds. It's funnier than I made it sound. I would encourage you guys to check it out. It's a really good, you know, I mean, we have fun, you know.
Okay.
I think you mostly will enjoy how much fun we have.
Okay, that sounds fair, I guess.
Comedy comes from.
Zubin started on the same day that I started.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Hired before me.
Well, we won't get into that.
But,
What? Is that, oh, really?
Dan's always held that against you, and in fact, this inviting you onto the podcast was an elaborate prank to get
an
even.
Airing of grievances.
But I convinced Dan not to fill a bucket with pig's blood and dump it on your head.
No, I want it. I want it. Let's get it out. Let's clear the air publicly.
No, I don't think we need that.
I would like to be the first step of the podcast evolution towards more of a grievance of airs.
What?
Airing grievances.
Grievance of airs.
And a grievance of airs.
Shakespeare's grievance of airs. Now, let the healing begin by smothering Zubin in pig's blood.
I was actually very glad that we started together. That we had, because I definitely had someone who was, you know, was also like thrown into the fire. Yeah, yeah.
And I was glad because it was two more people who were junior to me at the show.
Well, you already had three people junior.
Yeah, but five is even better.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, it's always better to just keep
like
rising.
An old man.
I became an old writing hand, and now I could haze you guys. Speaking of which. Go do some push-ups in your own vomit.
Oh, God.
You have to, because I've been at my job longer than you have.
Every three hours.
I call them up in the middle of the night and wake them up and make them do vomit push-ups.
I mean, the thing is, my stomach is empty by now is the thing.
You got to make sure to eat a big dinner.
I'm just throwing up blood.
You're going to take us out to dinner?
No.
Oh. I'll get away with this from the hazing.
I was in
a fraternity in college that technically was not allowed to haze and did not physically hazed, but psychologically hazed very well. And use a lot of deception, a lot of sudden surprises. That turned out like
surprises. I wonder what this is, like,
the surprises they warn you about. Yeah, hey, I'm gonna jump out of these bushes at you.
No, but I'm just imagining you.
Three, two, and I'm jumping out now.
No, but
I'm not suddenly surprised.
I just imagine the hazing like being like you open your door and you find a big like bouquet of balloons.
Where did these come from?
This is sudden.
No, it was a lot. It wasn't any like it was a kind of thing that looking back on it. Which I assume is not the case of physical hazing, but looking back on it, you're like, that was pretty clever and smart putting me through that emotional turmoil. And I don't feel any problem doing it again in the next class. But, you know, physical hazing, I wouldn't think that, you know, quite so much. But.
Yeah, you'd feel it.
Yeah, I'd feel it. Yeah.
Nothing that leaves scars.
Nothing that leaves scars.
Like, just like maybe like a rubber hose or some oranges.
Yeah, rubber pantyhose or.
More pantyhose.
Eating oranges, gross.
That was most of what the hazing was. He was eating like a lot of oranges.
Just making sure you didn't get scurvy.
Yeah, this
was a fraternity and not a pirate ship.
I might have just joined an orange club. I might have just joined an orange enjoyment.
Orange
I might have just visited
club.
Florida. I thought that was 4 years
so
of fraternity.
This one's called a navel. A navel orange. Oh, this is a blood orange. Hmm.
No, that means it was oppression and exploitation.
Oh, yeah.
Like
very
that movie
sad.
Blood Orange with Leonardo DiCaprio. These oranges were
really
mined in Africa.
They call them conflict oranges now. They don't want to.
Yeah, that's way better.
Yeah, yeah. They're euphemized. That's actually fine. I never thought about.
Because the reason they call them blood diamonds is so people stop buying them. Business is really going down with the blood diamonds. Let's just call them conflict diamonds.
Yeah, conflict diamonds are, you know, like they just argued over these diamonds.
Speaking of arguing over diamonds, well, actually, we should get to that.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That was a good segue to the movie. But first, we should thank everyone who came out to our 12-round screening on Friday, January 20th.
Not Jubin.
Jubin wasn't there.
I did not. I was
doesn't
busy.
Care enough about the podcast.
Did not care.
But we had a sold-out crowd, a lot of great fans. It was a really fun night. I hope everyone who came had a good time. We had people from all over the country and otherwise. Mm-hmm. Two guys.
From out of the country.
From out of the country.
Toronto.
Toronto. Two guys took a bus down from Boston just for the screening and then took the bus back that night.
There's a woman from Cincinnati. Not John from Cincinnati. A lady from Cincinnati.
Well, John from Cincinnati is not a woman and is actually a TV
show.
That's
what I said.
You guys are pretty popular along mid-sized cities.
Oh, yeah. Boston, Toronto. Yeah. Toronto's pretty big. Cincinnati.
But not so much in the major markets. Here in our hometown.
But it reminded us, or reminded me at least, that like people do listen to this stupid thing that we do, which was a great feeling, and we have a lot of great fans. We're just good people and who are very friendly and are the kind of fans that we want, the kind of listeners we want.
There was a trivia question about the popcorn trick that was surprisingly detailed. A gentleman rattled off basically our whole shtick about the popcorn trick.
I'm amazed at how well people know this podcast, to the extent of knowing, like, anecdotes that I've told on it, or like you said, like knowing the popcorn trick problems basically verbatim, or it was impressive.
Yeah. So thank you to the fans.
Thank you, everyone who came. We hope to do another one someday. Not for a long time, though.
Thank you to the fans.
No, it's you and you.
Even they're not your fans.
Oh, I just wanted, well, thank you.
I mean,
guys, anyway.
After this episode, yes, but before that,
free thank you to the fans.
So speaking of conflict over diamonds.
Yeah.
What movie did we watch today, Dan?
We watched a movie called Trespass.
Now, before this movie came up as a possibility, I had never heard of it, despite the fact that it was directed by Joel Schumacher and stars Nicolas Cage and Nicole Kidman, two of the most famous Nicks in Hollywood. did it come out in theaters, Dan?
It did come out in theaters, briefly, but it holds the record for shortest window of time between theatrical release and DVD or video of any kind.
Yeah, it beat the record held by From Justin to Kelly,
which
itself was just a cash-in on American Idol.
It was 18 days from theater to DVD.
It was in the theater for less than 10 days, and according to Wikipedia, it had a budget of around $35 million, and it grossed around $25,000 in theaters in 10 days. Now, that's roughly $2,500 a day for a movie, and that's like, so at any given time, so during its release, around 250 people saw it a day. So
I did not know 18 days from theater to DVD. I feel like the first day it's in theaters, you got to start running off the DVDs, right? Like they had to know like right away. We got to get this.
They knew
this
was
going to
be
a
huge hit, so they just made the DVDs ahead of time.
Just get stacked
from
warehouses.
They knew this was just going to be people are going to be climbing up the walls trying to get into the studio to take these DVDs.
Yeah.
From
it
us.
Really punches up to like how false that like release window is. It's like they don't need a lot of time to gear up to get those DVDs out there.
Well, it's like the old thing when the state DVDs were not available, but they had been made. And MTV had done a DVD set for the TV show The State and then just left them in a warehouse for like over a year at least. And you would see online people from the state be like, yeah, please write a letter to MTV to tell them to release this thing that is made already that will cost them no more money to do anything with.
A hostage, if you will, which gets us back to...
Speaking of hostages,
Trespass.
This movie Trespass.
You've been speaking of Trespass without talking about Trespass several times already.
Now... I at first thought this was a Spanish movie called Tres Pas, about three passages.
I feel like, again, we're getting off track, but I went to a Spanish restaurant last week, and I very much enjoyed it.
I don't know what that has to do with anything that we're talking about, save that for the podcast, our cooking podcast. A lot of people think it's about pot. It's actually about cooking things in pots.
Yeah, the Hashcast is the podcast.
And don't get it mixed up with our Potscast, which is our Antipots podcast.
You guys
we just talk about Antipots.
A lot about Hot to Trot.
Hot to Trot, Ghostbusters 2, show that she did on Lifetime where she was friends with a black lady.
I feel you guys need to consolidate these podcasts.
Who's Harry Crumb?
Everyone was in Who's Harry Crumb. Okay. It was a variable who's who of Who's Harry Crumb.
These multiple podcasts wouldn't be such a big deal if you guys didn't have them bleed over into each
there
podcast.
There really is a lot of overlap.
Very confusing names.
There's the Cast, our fishing podcast.
Poorly
the Casts
out.
Cast, which is our Broken Bones podcast.
The Cash Cast, which is our Cash Cab podcast.
Yeah, that's where we drive people around in our podcast and ask them quiz questions.
Which is not to be confused with the Crash Cast, where you drive that same car but crash it into... various poles, objects. Yeah.
You know, walls, things like that. Yeah, and store windows. On the crash. So anyway, and there's also our Crash Cast, which is our discussion of the movie Crash.
Right.
Every week.
Which is by far the most popular one. You guys, that one gets a lot of views.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, Oscar nominated.
The point I wanted to make was that it seems like more people may hear about the movie from this podcast than ever actually watched it.
And which, we're doing a service to Joel Schumacher.
Yes. Would normally make me feel bad, but it's Joel Schumacher and Nicolas Cage and Nicole Kidman. Like, they're big names in this movie. And it's the return, the triumphant return of Cam Gigandet to the podcast. Our favorite name. Mm-hmm. Our favorite
that
actor.
Name that we're not sure. It could be Gigandet, but we're going to keep saying Cam Gigandet.
Cam Gigandet.
It's more funny. It's more fun to say.
It sounds like a kid robot.
And the daughter in this movie, also a previous Flophouse star.
No, I don't think it was the daughter.
My Soul to Take.
It was the. I don't think it was the daughter, was it?
Oh, not the daughter. It was the friend of the daughter.
The friend of the daughter, Kendra.
Friend of the daughter.
Who we briefly see in a low-cut top, and then we don't see her much. But anyway.
We spend the rest of the movie wishing that we saw her again.
But what's the. Okay, so we know the movie was a big bomb. We know it stars Nyx, plural, and old fan friend of the podcast, Nicolas Cage. What's the movie about, you ask?
What's the movie about, Elliot?
I'm glad you asked. Nicolas Cage is a diamond broker with a big fancy modernist house. He's married to Nicole Kidman, but it's a cold marriage. There's no sex between them. And we know this because he breaks a dinner date to go do business, and we see her wistfully looking at underpants that she had wanted to wear
for
him.
And then she tries to kiss him, and he like moves his face
away.
He's
like a cold fish.
I don't know why that happens.
And they have a daughter who argues with her parents and sneaks out of the house to go to a party. And now Nicolas Cage's performance starts out being kind of bland, and by the end of the movie becomes ridiculous. But we'll get to that. So Nicolas Cage and Nicole Kidman are at home. Suddenly, a sheriff knocks on the door and says, "We need you to let us into the house. There's been trouble in the neighborhood." Turns out it's not the sheriff. It's a bunch of robbers disguised as security people. And they have been following Nicolas Cage around for days, watching him do things. And they're convinced he has millions of dollars and diamonds all over the house.
You're aware from the start that these guys are robbers because the security cam in this incredibly elaborate and complex security system this house has only shows their chests where you see the badge.
It's a chest-high security cam.
It's a chest-high security cam, which seems like a major overlap or oversight in the movie until you learn, and there's like, and this is one of many twists in the movie, that the security cam system itself was installed
by the crooks.
By the crooks.
Led by Cam Gajandit.
Mm-hmm. Led by Cam Gajandit.
Gams Gamandit.
Gams Gamandit.
Gams Demandit. Who, there's so many twists and turns in this movie. It's hard to remember all of them. But there is a chest high cleavage cam security camera. They go in. Nicolas Cage won't let them open up his safe. He says he doesn't have any diamonds. And then it turns out, let's just go through the twists in no particular order, shall we?
Yes.
So Cam Gajandit.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, it's a pretty basic,
it's a very basic
home invasion story until all of a sudden they throw like eight twists at you.
Like one after the other. The first 35 minutes of the movie are very straightforward. Then it gets a little like slow, and then it's just twist after twist, just like constant twistiness. So Cam Gajandit put in the security cameras. It appears he also slept with Nicole Kidman because she's lonely while he was there.
Yeah, which is also suggested by a lot of longing looks the two give to each other in flashbacks.
That are superimposed on each other. Yeah. Joel Schumacher uses everything in his bag of tricks, in his directorial toolbox, to show us there's chemistry between these two. Which he needs, because in real life there is no chemistry between these two.
There's no chemistry between anybody, I don't think, in this entire movie. Like, nobody really seems to connect anybody else.
I think they're all shot on different days. I think they're just composite.
Together with computers.
A lot of single shots.
It's like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
They decided to experiment. They wanted to shoot a movie the same way you record voices for a cartoon. Just different people separately.
Different rooms.
Okay, the daughter comes back, and there's a lot of running around and a lot of yelling and people going, "Shut the fuck up! Get the fuck down!" You know, like just firing guns in the air. Nicolas Cage gets shot like two or three times.
That's one thing also, is that the very first second something goes wrong, all four of these crooks just fall apart. Like
they start yelling at each other.
Yeah, they've all got numerous entanglements themselves and cannot keep it together.
It's three guys and a girl and a pizza place.
Yeah.
And the guy,
that's hilarious.
And the leader of the robbers and the girl have a relationship. The girl is a drug addict and immediately leaves the room when the robbery starts to go smoke crack, I guess.
Yeah, like,
and
yeah.
trying Nicole Kidman's clothes.
And trying Nicole Kidman's clothes and watch Nicole Kidman's baby movies from when their daughter was growing up.
Which just seems to be an excuse to see her in a thong a couple times. Yeah. Which, again, not complaining.
Dan is fine with that.
But
it definitely seems that she breaks down at the beginning of the movie and spends the entire rest of the movie broken down. Like in
wandering
tears.
Around in a haze.
Yeah, like not making any sense, mm-hmm. like begging
a real
everybody.
Lady Macbeth.
Yeah.
A real Lady and the Tramp Macbeth.
Yeah, I didn't see the Shakespearean parallels until just now, but now this makes
Lady
this
Macbeth
makes a lot
and the
more
Tramp.
Sense.
Either that works, right? Lady Macbeth and the Tramp.
And the Tramp.
Sure. Why don't you make that hit YouTube video, Ellie?
I think I will. And she tells the Tramp to kill the Italian chefs so they can run the Italian restaurant and have all the spaghetti they want.
The web of relationships is that the girlfriend. The female robber is the girlfriend of the older brother robber.
The robber who slept with Nicole Kidman and installed the security camera is brothers with the lead robber.
Yes, the younger brother.
Who does a lot of yelling about, it's called trust. We need to establish trust here between us and you people that we're robbing. Nicolas Cage tells them.
And then there's also like a hulking guy who they all seem scared of.
Yeah, that even the robbers are afraid of. It turns out Nicolas Cage says to them, "We don't have any money. It's all debt. We thought we owned this house, but it owns us." Which briefly makes you think maybe the house is haunted, but it's not. They just have they're underwater on this house. It's very topical, and that he says, "We don't have any diamonds. We don't have any money." They say like, "Oh no, what are we gonna do? There's got to be something." And the lead robber says, "We need this money to buy a kidney for our mom who's dying. So we need to take your daughter's kidney." And John Nicolas Cage is like, "No, no, take my kidney, take my kidney." And they're about to slash his back open, and the lead robber's like, "We don't need any kidneys. Yeah. We're here for money." And then it's, so why did we bother with that? What's the?
It's only at the beginning of the movie. They're there to get supposedly the diamonds, and Nicolas Cage suggests a plan because he said the diamonds are laser micro-etched to be coded to whoever owns them. And he suggests to them that he be their middleman. So they essentially rob the diamonds from him and then give them back to him.
And then he gives them the money.
Yeah. This is this takes up like a good like 10 minutes.
At least. Yeah. Well, they established the beginning
so it goes
that Nicholas
from diamonds to money to kidney. And then back to money.
And then back to money. Nicolas Cage, they establish, is like a smooth-talking salesman. Like, he's a hustler. He gets by on his being able to argue people and convince them. And you think that's going to be his way out of this predicament, but it never really works that well.
Yeah.
And usually he ends up shot or stabbed or just with his hand crushed or just beat up.
I like the idea that like this happens to him every day, like his smooth talking ways that he tries, and then it'll be get him shot or stabbed in the hand.
He just limps home bloody every day. This house is not worth it. Even if we have an infinity pool, it's not worth it.
No.
I'll just go through the twists quickly, and then we talk about what order people get killed in.
Great.
So he says we don't have any diamonds. Then they ask for a kidney. Turns out they don't want a kidney. Then it turns out that the relationship between Cam Gajandet, there's a lot of mind games that people are playing with each other. Mm-hmm. Then it turns out Cam Gajandet imagined the whole relationship with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, he's on antipsychotic meds.
And he is on antipsychotic medicine. And then the older brother throws the medicine away for, I don't know, I'm not sure what reason.
Those are Tic Tacs. Like, he was not taking, he was
pretending
to take
his medication. Well, that's what the older
medication.
Brother says, but I'm not. Oh, you're saying he was just pretending
the
entire time?
He was pretending to take antipsychotic meds, but he was just Tic Tacs, and the older brother realized that when he tries them himself.
I see. Maybe they were just the kind of meds that give you minty fresh breath.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. There was another. Oh, so, and then it turns out he needs the money because the lead brother is a drug dealer for the mob, and his girlfriend, the girl, is a stripper for the same mobster. And so he was doing so well as a drug dealer that they gave him this huge shipment of coke, $180,000 worth. And while he was having sex in the front seat of his car with his girlfriend, robbers come up and steal the drugs from him. So he needs the money to pay back for the drugs he lost.
And that's why they're so scared of the hulking guy, because the hulking guy is from like the drug cartel
works for
or
the
whatever.
Mobster.
Yeah.
But then it turns out that the mobster eventually reveals. The mobster gets injected with a chemical that puts him to sleep for a long time. But then when he finally wakes up, he reveals that he's attacking Cam Gajandet. The older brother shoots him in the back to save Cam Gajandet, and then as he's dying, it's like an opera where someone has a lot of time after their shot to talk. He explains that, "No, you don't understand. Your brother set you up. the mob stole those drugs back from you that it gave to you so that you'd be under their thumb and do anything they said. And it was because your brother told us where you were going to be with the drugs. So we stole them back and your brother betrayed you. Yeah. And then he dies. And then there's a lot of running around and chasing. There's a lot of yelling. Nicolas Cage gets beat up a lot.
Yeah, the lead brother is going to kill Nicole Kidman, but then Kangra Janet kills the brother because he's in love
to save Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage... shoot, and then Kangra Janet finds out there really is a lot of money in the basement. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars.
That's the final twist.
That's the final twist. And then there's somehow gasoline got knocked over, and Nicolas Cage lights it on fire, and then takes a nail gun and shoots the nails into Kangra Janet's feet so he can't move. And he gets engulfed in flame, and the family escapes.
Nicole Kidman comes in and gets a... Nicolas Cage, who's been shot in the inside of the leg, which, by the way, is where your femoral artery is, and you would bleed out immediately, like within seconds. But he got shot in the inside leg, and then like later he gets shot in the gut, and he manages to do all this to Kangra Janet, and Nicole Kidman takes him out. And at the end of the movie, they're all on the lawn.
The house
and
is on fire.
And then cut to credits, and you have no idea whether he survived.
They're lying on the ground, the three of them, one on top of each other, like a family lies down, then you hear sirens in the background. Fade to black.
Mm-hmm.
So all the robbers are dead. A real security guard who shows up near the end of the movie gets shot dead by Kangra Janet. And there's also and the girl robber.
Yeah, she's...
So the daughter says, I know where there is money. I was at this party. This is something we see earlier. She's at a party, and the douchebag who is running the party to impress her shows her a safe with a gun in it and like tons and tons of cash in bricks. And he's like, there's $100,000 in here. You know, in case of, I don't know, the economy collapses or 9/11 or something. Like, I don't remember what he says. It's really stupid. And she leaves the party. So she says, I can take you to this house. It's 20 minutes away. We'll get lots of money. And the girl robber goes with her in a car.
But not before changing back into a thong again.
Not before they change their clothes into party clothes.
Look, they don't want to be conspicuous while they're robbing money from this party.
Yeah,
I guess so, yeah. And then the robber girl's like, I'm going to shoot all your friends. I'm going to shoot everybody because you can't do anything about it because you can't do anything. And the girl speeds up the car and aims for a traffic pole and then quickly unlatches the robber's seatbelt. Car crashes. Next thing we see, the airbags have not gone off. The girl is fine. The girl robber is, I don't know, dead? I don't know what, but... she's just sitting there. The car is in pretty good shape considering it just crashed, and the daughter runs away.
But this is and I said it at the time. This is my favorite thing in the whole movie because early in the movie, when the daughter sneaks out and she's like Kendra's driving her, Kendra almost crashes into that same traffic pole, and so it feels like the movie feels like it needs to set up the fact that people can crash into poles or else we're not going to believe the way that this woman gets killed at the end of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, this is a movie that's so intricately plotted. Mm-hmm. Everything's there.
Everything pays off.
Everything pays off.
Except for everything. One of the great things about this movie is characters suddenly go from being like cowardly and sniveling on the floor to suddenly doing enormous act of bravery. Like at one point, Nicole Kidman... who is like most of the movie is on the floor crying of some sort, begging the robbers to leave her family alone, gets up, like puts a guy in an arm lock and grabs a syringe and like points it very close to his neck and just starts shouting commands to all the robbers as if she was, I honestly expected some sort of like secret to be that she was trained in some sort of martial arts or like a cop herself. It was so fluid and quick. And then
it's the, like in movies where you see like, ordinary people are really good at punching and can take a lot of punishment. Like, this is that kind of movie.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be an average family, but, like, they're pretty good at fighting, and Nicolas Cage takes a shitload of punishment. Like, they crush his hand, they shoot him a couple times.
Well, but the other thing, I mean, like, there's that, but there's the flip side of that, which is when they, like, seem utterly incompetent. Like, there's a point
at family
which...
I mean, everybody seems incompetent. In this
movie. But there's a point at which, like, a knife gets stabbed into a table right next to Nicolas Cage. And Nicolas Cage basically does that, like, comedy thing where, like, you turn your, like, fingers into someone walking along the table.
The two robbers are arguing, and he's slowly reaching over to pick up that knife. But it's like he's in a slow pick-up-a-knife contest.
Yeah.
Like, how slow can you pick up a knife?
And it's also one of those things where, you know, I feel like anyone with any... any experience in life sort of knows that if you want to do something surreptitiously, you do it quickly rather than stretching it out as long as you possibly can. Well, like you can just grab the knife and stab someone.
Well, he knows that robbers have vision like frogs or T-Rexes.
Oh, right.
They see motion. They can't see things that are standing still.
It's like
That's science.
It's like an actual movie theater is when somebody wants to like open, like unwrap something and just does it very slowly, which is like 100 times worse than just opening it right away.
I'm going to extend this crinkling as long as I can.
But the robbers are really shitty at being robbers too. Like they break into the house and they're like, we know everything about you. We've been watching you. We know everything. And over the course of the movie, it's revealed that they really don't know what they're doing. They have no plan. All of them are crazy. They don't like each other. And it, like, you would only need to tweak this a little bit for it to be like a knockabout farce about like incompetent robbers.
You just need one person to dress as a different gender in order for this to be just a complete farce.
Well, we're talking about during the movie, like, it was like, okay, well, the robbers think that they have all these diamonds. Oh, Nicolas Cage doesn't have any diamonds. Then they think he has a bunch of money. It's like, oh, it turns out he doesn't have the money. Then there's a necklace that they're going to get. Like, oh, they get the necklace, and he's like, oh, it's fake. I traded it in for the house, like, and they smash it, like, the fake necklace. And it turns into a movie about, like, hostages that bedevil the hostage takers. Like, it's like, oh, come on. You're just wasting our time now, Nicolas
Cage. The hostage takers are, like, falling apart by the end of the movie. they don't really seem like much of a threat.
Yeah, they're like, I feel like it's like, most of these like hostage movies or invasion or heist movies have like one wild card, but everyone of the robbers in this movie is a wild card.
It feels
in some
like
way.
The screenwriter was like, "Why don't I make them all wild cards?"
Who knows what anyone's going to do at any one point?
Even the guy who's like the big tough guy, who's a professional, who's there to keep them in line, is kind of a crazy person who flies off the handle.
Yeah,
a crazy person. There's the drug addict stripper lady. There's the fuck up drug dealer, and then there's the person who's on antipsychotic medication.
I mean, it's like the X-Men. It sounds like a superhero team.
Yeah, that's one. Although I will say the number of twists and the way they're all revealed, every twist is revealed in a very dramatic monologue or some sort of shocked utterance that is then followed by the next person hearing it saying, "What did you just say?" It's all very. Not only are there so many twists, but they're all revealed as if they're the only twist in the movie that explains it, and which then becomes very entertaining to me after
all. And then the druggy girlfriend's like, no, it can't be. No, come on.
After a certain point, you'd think that they'd just be like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I buy that.
I get it. Everything is going wrong. I guess in a way that's more realistic. I mean, this is probably more like
there's nothing
the way
realistic about this. This is not in any way what real life is like.
It's probably more realistic that that's what like a group of criminals is like. I'm saying like a group of semi incompetent.
They are most criminals are not a crack elite. It's not like Die Hard where they're an elite squad of mercenaries that have everything timed out to the second. And it's only the one X factor of a New York City cop with no shoes.
Oh, my God. This sounds like a good movie.
it was made already years ago.
Oh, no. Elliot, I'm looking forward to this movie you're making.
No, I'm not making it. It's been made. It's called Die Hard.
What a big movie. I would like to give you $2 million to make this movie.
The movie cost way more than $2 million.
Well, I think I can only raise $2
million. I'm amazed you can raise that much.
I'll take this money, and I'll make this movie. I'll give you a DVD of this movie that I'll make it for just $2 million. I'll
get Bruce Willis to be in it, but he'll look younger.
See, Juben is the kind of can-do guy I'm looking for, Elliot. With you.
You're right. I'm a can't-do guy. I can't make a movie that was already made 20 years ago.
One thing I like about this movie is the fact that like with all these twists, like the very first 5 minutes of this break-in, it seems like this is like a SEAL Team 6 operation. Like they even do like the trick where they're like, what's the code to the alarm? And it gives them the wrong code.
But they know the right code.
And they know the right code. So you're thinking like, oh, these guys like tracked him down like a long time. But then like within like 2 minutes after that, everything like the girls are smoking crack in the room and putting on another dress. The guys are shouting each other to like calm the fuck down. They're showing a level of falling apart, which usually happens like 90 minutes into a 2-hour heist.
It's as if like Reservoir Dogs they all come back from that robbery that went horribly wrong and they're all mad at each other. It's as if that happened the minute they walked into the place they were robbing. Like, as if Reservoir Dogs was about them fucking up this robbery instantly. Like, the only way they could screw it up more is if, like, they couldn't get the door open or if they hold up their guns and the cartridges are just falling the clips are just falling right out of the bottom. Their pants are falling down. Their masks just disappear because they're made out of, like, some kind of flash paper. It's
But likewise, I mean, like, Nicolas
their
Cage.
Their moms are in the bank. Like, Junior?
No. This is also, and as a result, this is the shoutiest movie I think we've ever seen in this podcast.
Yeah.
Oh,
almost
really?
Every,
oh,
yeah. And we watched 12 Rounds, which is a loud movie. But almost every line in this movie is, shut the fuck up. Yeah. Or like, get the fuck down. Or no, no, no. That basically.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that Nicolas Cage goes from, like, the boring, like, disengaged Nicolas Cage that we've seen a lot of recently.
Yeah.
To like crazy fucking Nicolas Cage
quickly. He does a lot of talking like this. Near the end. It's like his voice. It's like his voice. It goes from like Zero to Giamatti to George Lucas. Like those are the voices. So he's like, leave my family alone. To like, did you ever know the etymology of the word diamond? It's like, why? Why bother with that?
But also, like, immediately upon getting kidnapped, like, he is at climax levels of, like, yelling and despair and craziness. I mean, it is like a weird, like, it is like a home invasion Joel Schumacher Tennessee Williams thing going on.
That's another thing, too, by the way, what you're saying about the etymology of diamonds, like several times in the movie, Nicolas Cage gives almost like a mini lecture on some subject. At one point, even starts like discussing with the robbers the leverage he has and what leverage is and how it's useful in his negotiations. I don't know if that's...
It was a promotion for the show Leverage.
It's one of those... There's something that started out as kind of a neat thing in movies where characters would give little mini speeches on like... weird subjects, like, and then it got totally overused, and like Aaron Sorkin does it in everything he writes. But it seems like every character has their little speech where they're like, you know, when I was a boy, my mom always used to tell me, and here's what's interesting about that, and here's a fact I heard somewhere. And it's like, maybe one of those per movie is okay. But like, all the characters seem like they just read a really interesting book and they can't wait to share. Like, or they heard something on Jeopardy that they didn't know and they're going to tell everybody what it is.
I mean, to go back to Reservoir Dogs, I mean, I feel like Quentin Tarantino is good at doing that.
And
people see that and they're like, oh, I can do that.
And the thing is, that became like one of the tics that people picked up on about Tarantino, but he doesn't do it as much as you think he does. It's just when he does it, they're memorable. Like the whole Royale with Cheese thing in Pulp Fiction, like, there's not that many other things like that in the movie,
right?
Where there's just kind of like a non sequitur fact talk, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, the like a virgin thing at the beginning of Reservoir Dogs is like that's really the only thing there. Yeah,
and in Inglourious Basterds, it's when Christoph Waltz goes through basically the plot of each season of Charles in Charge.
Yeah, yeah,
very strange, anachronistic, but I mean, it's a movie where they kill Hitler.
It's a Fantasia.
So.
It's a Fantasia on World War II themes. Yeah. See, and then the interesting thing is that the Powell family moves out, a new family moves in, but Charles stays in charge.
It was very smart, though, because he deliberately made a mistake in the third season that got the Jews hiding under the floorboards to be like, that's not right, and that's how they
discovered about that scene is you're like, oh, he's talking about Charles in Charge, that all Jews love that, and you want them to be quiet, but they just cannot resist from correcting him.
And the irony in the scene is that Christoph Waltz is the one in charge the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. What weird. A good movie, Inglourious Basterds. Just well done.
I mean, it is. I mean, not the crazy version that we just made up.
Inglourious Charles in Charge.
Inglourious
Bayos. That's what it is.
I don't mean to shift the discussion to that, but I do remember like watching that movie, not realizing like how much of a like this is really just going to go off the rails in terms of like historical accuracy. Thinking up to like the last 2 minutes, they've really written themselves into a corner with this fire. Like, how are they going to get Hitler out of here? And then like the end, I was like, oh, wow, I guess we're not.
And what I loved about Tarantino's explanation for that was he was like, the characters don't know how history is supposed to go. They don't know that Hitler doesn't die here. So why can't they kill Hitler? And it's such a perfect explanation. Like, yeah, you're right. It's not like the characters are going to leave a back door open because they know Hitler doesn't die till 1945.
That's true. Yeah, that's a very clever way of responding to it.
But anyway, Trespass. I found myself way more entertained by this movie than I thought I was going to be, even though it was really, like, because it was stupid. It was really stupid and loud, and at any given moment, someone was about to get hurt or yell at somebody else.
Or reveal some new motivation
or that we never knew about. And Cam Gajanet gets into a fight with the big guy at the end and is just being slammed against the floor. Like, there's a bunch of hits
broken
in this
glass,
that are really, look like they really hurt.
He receives like 7 blows that would render anybody automatically unconscious.
Yeah, but he has psycho strength.
He has psycho strength. That's true. That's true.
But that's the
freshest breath and psychoest mind ever.
Joel Schumacher like makes these movies where he's just really cruel to his characters and really like beats the shit out of them. And it like, I remember in Phone Booth, which is not a good movie, but there's one scene where he's on the phone with Kiefer Sutherland while the prostitutes and the pimp are, I don't even remember why they want to yell at him, but they're like banging on the outside of the phone booth while he's trying to deal with Kiefer Sutherland. Like he has too much stimuli that he can't all respond to. And that was the only moment in that movie that was any good to me, because it was like, this is really making me anxious. Like, there's too much going on for this character to deal with.
Well, I mean, it's something that you can relate to. Like, leave me alone in the fucking phone booth. And I'm on the phone.
And it doesn't totally make up for the fact that the character in that movie is being punished for having had a lustful thought about a woman who is not his wife.
Is that really what the...
Yeah, it turns out he has to admit at the end that he was sexually attracted to this woman who works for him, but he never acted on it.
Sleep together.
The sniper makes him reveal this to his wife. Like, she's really sexy, and I felt that, but we never acted on it. I never want to date with her. It's like...
He's being punished for being a human being.
Yeah. Like Jimmy Carter wrote this script. Like, he felt lust in his heart. That's just as bad.
What's like? Who is it doing that?
I forget how Kiefer Sutherland knows these things about him. It's this crazy sniper who just traps him in this phone booth.
This is also the same problem with Trespass, the idea that like there's no, you don't, it doesn't matter how a twist is revealed or set up, or if he even relies on information the audience did not know. Any twist is an interesting, new, exciting twist that'll change the audience's, that'll make the audience more excited. Like, and at certain points in this movie, especially by the end of it, there's just so much that you just don't really... You know, you're no longer invested in any of the characters anymore. You just want like the, but it almost makes you dependent on the twists for plot, for just being engaged. At a certain number of twists, a certain critical mass of twists, you need like many, many more twists. You know, you need you need nothing but twists after, I would say. Like, if you can't have
an accelerating number.
Yeah. If you have like 3 twists in the movie, you need 30 twists, and you need them all to be revealed like exponentially.
And the twists have to get crazier each time, or bigger each time. So like, oh, and it turns out Nicolas Cage is Cam Gajandit's father. And it turns out this is a world where apes rule. And
Yeah, well, it's a movie. That's what I.
That's
have to
what
say
it was. It was a failure of a movie.
But I think that we have to give our final judgments now. We're about that time.
Final judgments.
This is where we decide whether this was a good, bad movie.
Whether it is scarily horrifying.
No. Again,
terrifyingly good.
Those are only special Shocktober categories.
Creepily bad, good.
I wish I'd done the October one. It's not like much more exciting categories.
And Stuart sometimes rates it on a scale of wormy boners. No. Nobody else uses
that. Not a canonical method of rating. No one understands what it means.
It doesn't mean anything. He makes up the numbers each time. I'm not even really sure what a wormy boner is.
I'm assuming it's a boner with worms in it.
Oh, that's horrible. Gross. Like a corpse boner?
Yeah.
Just like that movie, Tim Burton's The Corpse Boner?
Yeah. I thought you said wormy, as in like it's a warm... pleasant boner, as opposed to the sort of colder, you know, like
those cold boners,
the cold, like the ones like you're just not
from that cold blood that's rushing into your penis.
Well, like when Mr. Freeze is aroused.
Yeah.
Okay. No, is this a good bad movie? A movie that you derive pleasure from because it is bad? A bad bad movie? A movie you just dislike, or a movie you kind of like? One that you find redeeming facets about? Elliot,
I think I'm gonna say I thought it was a good bad movie.
Yeah,
I didn't think I was gonna enjoy it at all. But it was so stupid, and the twists kept coming by the end, and it was so loud and fast that even though it is really bad, it was bad in a funny way.
Yeah, Jubin?
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that too. There's like twists are pretty entertaining after a certain point. You know, that's like I think I would go so far as to say that excessive plot twists are what separate a bad movie from a good bad movie.
Interesting.
Yeah,
the Prang theory of good, bad, bad, bad.
Yeah, like the
dynamics.
Separation line, I would say the Prang theory is that. The number of plot twists is very highly correlated with good, bad.
It's been a while since we've had one of these, but I'm also going to say...
You're right, too long.
Good, bad. This is a good, bad movie. It's, you know, it's very fast. It's 90 minutes long. I mean, there is a bit of a drag in the middle.
It definitely gets draggy when the characters have yelled at each other and thrown each other to the ground for the 80th time.
But there's a lot of twists. It's only 90 minutes. It's a masterclass in terrible acting.
There's some good CGI fire at the end.
Yeah. Kanga Janet just like bursts into flame. like he had like a big drink of kerosene before.
Yeah. Quickly becomes the fire. Like, yeah, very much.
I wish they just went all the way and had evil spirits escaping from his body while he was on fire.
Wow. So that's a good. That's a I'm
yeah.
Happy
good.
About that.
Good bad movie. Yeah. Trespass.
It was worth it. I think it was worth a
Tres Pasos.
I have a few letters to read here.
This is the part where we answer fan letters.
You guys get fan letters? This is.
Oh yeah. This is a high class operation you've hooked up with.
I wish I hadn't revealed all that information about my fraternity. I didn't know it was going to be so popular.
This is from someone who says, "Call me Mippy on air."
Okay, Mippy. That's weird. I hope it's not a sex thing.
Give me the dignity of Mippy.
They call me Mr. Mippy.
And she says, it's an email titled Meow.
Already off a good start. No, so wow. Mippy wrote to say meow. Are you sure this is not
it's not a cat who's learned to work a computer?
Yeah.
No, she says, "I work in a job that involves watching many film trailers. I'm being deliberately vague to avoid the sack." I think this is why she's calling herself Mippy.
Ah, I see. No, and you break that code, Mippy.
Your podcast makes me feel as though you're watching the whole thing, so I don't have to. So I have a suggestion. Did lesbian vampire killers make it over to the U.S.? I'm intrigued to know if it is awful, only if you are British and familiar with the charmless comedians which star within. With a title like that, you may expect trashy fun along the lines of Brain Dead, Dead Alive, but I have the feeling you won't be getting it.
I actually feel like I expect it to be a seduction cinema film with, like, Misty Monday in it.
Yeah. Well, I bring this up because to bolster my reputation as Pervazoid number one.
Have you seen this movie already?
I've seen Lesbian Vampire Killers. And
is it a British movie?
It's a British movie. It's a tongue in cheek. I mean, like, it's not.
They had Dan at lesbian, and they got him at vampire.
It's a comedy. It's a horror comedy. It's trying to be a comedy at least. But I bring this up to just, I feel like, diagnose a problem with exploitation films these days, which is that they're not exploitative enough. Mm. Like all of the exploitation,
they respect the actresses too much.
Elliot, I know some things, so don't pretend to respect womankind more than you actually do. But it's interesting to me that, like...
I know some things.
It's interesting to me that, like...
2 + 2 = 4, for one, so be quiet about women.
I just think it's funny that I feel like modern exploitation movies, even ones like especially ones that are, like, campy or tongue-in-cheek, like... They pack all of the exploitation into the title,
yeah,
and then they don't follow through. Like, I mean, like they don't
ironically
have the sense of fun that they need to have.
That's what most exploitation movies were like, though.
That's
like,
true.
Where they would give you a title that was really crazy, and maybe a couple moments for a trailer, and then the rest would be like characters driving between locations or bands that had paid to appear in the movie or things like that. But you're right. But people should have know better than to do that now, because they know what makes a good exploitation-y, you know, cheapy movie. You know?
Yeah. Like, I feel like, you know, we should have a higher class of exploitation by now, Zubin.
Because I'm not really familiar with modern exploitation movie. What would you say would be, like, a modern one, aside from Lesbian Vampire Killers? One that, like, would be more popular that I would know about, for example?
You know, I mean, Drive Angry 3D was basically a big-budget exploitation movie. Unfortunately, it didn't get the balance right, and there were times when it was a little too gross, like when you had the main, like, anytime a nude woman was on screen, they were either going to get beaten up or traumatized, and it was, like, a little too much.
Yeah, I don't need that.
But, I don't know, like, you know, Dan always has a soft spot for movies with, you know, bikini girls or things like that, you know, or...
Yeah, I mean,
people's heads exploding. But I mean, we all like those things.
I guess, yeah, when I think of exploitation, I think of, like, the trauma video, like, films of the 80s, like Toxic Avenger. I think of, I guess, like, Private School, like those movies where they were just basically thinly veiled excuses to show.
I do enjoy the 80s, teen 80s comedies.
I guess that's what I think of when I think of exploitation. That's probably not what
there's the horror side of it, you know, where you have, like, there was, like, some great stuff in the 80s, like Reanimator or Evil Dead, that was, like, not didn't have like the sex thing, but it was like a splatter comedy.
Well, it seems like exploitation movies kind of came up because people could make really cheap movies that they could get a lot of money on fast because they would just put in the elements that would play the lowest common denominator. And then you had basically it seemed like a generation or two of people who really liked those elements and were willing to put a certain amount of enthusiasm and craft and energy into making those movies. And they knew what buttons they had to hit, but they hit them harder and better because they liked doing it. It wasn't just a quick cash grab.
But now I feel like we have a generation of people who have nostalgia for the idea of exploitation, but want to make the PG-13 version.
They want to
of
make
that
it. They want to make an acceptable mainstream, respectable version, and you can't do it without losing that the frisson.
Yeah,
of,
exactly.
That made it.
I bet you, we're 10 years out from a Tarantino of 80s TNA movies.
Yeah.
I think like in 10, 15 years, you're going to sign someone like once our age gets to have control of directorial level studio money, you'll see like a resurgence of like 80s TNA, like an homage the way he does to those 70s slasher movies.
I kind of feel like the American Pie movies were a little bit like that.
Yeah, a little bit.
It was about a bunch of guys just trying to get laid. But like Tarantino seems to be one of the few guys who like gets the things that made those exploitation movies fun and has the end, does it to the hilt, you know?
Yeah.
But doesn't do it so much to the hilt that you're like, ugh, this makes me feel gross.
So to move on, this
.org
email is from...
You can make a difference.
Is this Mippy again?
Well, I'll just read it because she explains. But it's titled, An Excuse to Get Elliot to Talk Even More.
Yay! Oh. I don't need it. I don't need it, baby. Let me tell you about my day today.
I don't.
So I woke up.
Oh, God.
6:30 a.m. like always. Okay.
It says, I decided that since there's been confusion caused by the similarities in my first name and Dan's wife's first name, I would identify myself using only my last name, which is Aron. I think it's Aron. Maybe Aron. But I'll say Aron.
Aragorn.
Mm-hmm. Aragorn. I was recently perusing a copy of Earth the Book, which I had stolen from a local book merchant.
I don't approve of that.
No residuals for anyone?
We don't get royalties on that.
Royalties.
That's okay.
And I noticed that in the chapter on death, there's a picture of the Crypt Keeper. Knowing that Elliot was a writer for the book and knowing that he seems to be a fan of the puntastic corpse, I have to ask, how much begging and pleading was used in order to get the Crypt Keeper in the book? And how many puns went unpublished? Take as much time as possible to tell some of those jokes now in the Crypt Keeper's voice, of course. Thanks for all the laughs and tears, gents. I mean,
tears.
I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know whether you can say like what jokes were whose or anything.
I can say what some of which jokes were mine, but I don't remember whose were whose for all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does not take a lot to get the Crypt Keeper into a Daily Show thing. at some point, it was like the Daily Show decided that certain things that Elliot likes were just going to go in fairly easily, like the Crypt Keeper or the X-Men. Some things don't. I wrote a Mac and Me joke the other day that I thought was great that didn't get in. But
I mean, culturally, I think that Mac and Me has less penetration.
Is a touchstone. Is a major touchstone.
Okay.
But what was the – so what's the – I'm sorry, I lost track of the question.
Just a picture of Crypt Keeper.
But like that was, I don't think I wrote the Crypt Keeper joke. I don't think. But, there's a very specific sensibility that that the people at the show have, and I fit into it. So,
all right. Well, this email is titled.
But write in and ask about any other jokes, and I'll let you know if I wrote them or not.
This email is titled, Finally. It's from John, last name withheld, and it says, after 4 years, 4 months, and 8 days of Flophouse episodes, someone finally called Dan out on his inability to correctly pronounce the short E sound in the English language. I'm referring to Elliot's confusion starting around 1938 in the Conan the Barbarian episode upon hearing Dan apparently mention winches.
Yeah, you started talking about having sex with winches.
Mm-hmm. Why
this
weird. Why this particular abuse of our mother tongue happened to catch Elliot's ear, I'll never know. Coming as it did after 93 previous podcasts in which Dan opined about the temperature, observed tense moments,
temperature tense, yeah,
discussed revenge plots, and marveled at tentacle creatures.
Tentacle.
Later in
stupid
the
Illinois accent.
Conan episode, Dan read a letter in which a listener described Elliot as, according to Dan, a general pedant. This is what's commonly known as a teachable moment. Here was an opportunity for Dan to practice his short E sound in two consecutive words. Instead, he chose to horribly mispronounce both words, surely angering the pedantic champ versus chomp letter writer. But this time, his co-hosts were silent. Stewart, I assume, had slipped into his customary late episode Popeyes-induced coma. Doesn't eat Popeyes.
Stewart doesn't eat the Popeyes. I do.
But when Dan came for the short...
It's a Coors Light-induced coma.
When Dan came for the short E's, Elliot also said nothing. Perhaps when Dan comes for the doubled consonants, there will be no one left to speak for Elliot.
No!
John, last name withheld.
That hits me where I live.
P.S. 5 head and 7 pounds seem like tailor-made enemies. One demands a particular exact quantity in his crimes, while the other habitually adds one to the expected amount. Together, they could launch a golden age of OCD comic rivalries. Now, look,
I like the idea of a 5 head... 7 pounds crossover, I have to say.
Well, let's address this character assassination because
of your terrible way with pronouncing things.
Well,
see, pronouncing. He didn't even catch me there. It's pronouncing things.
God, your fans are both obsessive and very critical, which is the worst combination of characteristics for your fans to have. Yeah.
First, let me assure you that in day-to-day life, I've had plenty of people point out my inability to differentiate. For instance, between the thing people put in clothes
hangers,
and the thing people write with.
Markers.
No. Pen and pen. I say them the same.
Pin, oh, yeah. So you would say pig pen when you mean pig pen.
Look.
And you would say pen pig when you mean a pig that you use as a pen.
I don't think he switches them. He just can't say one.
I speak, in most cases... With a perfect newscaster's American accent. In this one case, for some reason, he decides that he needs to be a jerk and pick out my charming regionalism.
Like say entomology.
Entomology.
Yeah, entomology. Yeah, you say it all weird.
You know, Tom Brokaw has that one small glottal stop. I feel like this is what distinguishes you and gives
Tom
you that
Brokaw,
extra.
He can't even finish words.
But that's his thing, though. All the great newscasters have got one small distinguishing characteristics that really raise them above just the average effluvia of newscasters. So I'd say
it's like how Walter Cronkite, he only said the with a Spanish accent.
Yeah.
Today, the president went to, that kind of thing.
I mean, everyone has their charming regionalisms. I mean, no one has called Stewart out on his amazing Fort Wayne accent.
I can't even tell. He sounds like Shakespeare himself.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like the platonic ideal of the English language.
Stewart has one of the most extravagant voices of anyone I've met, and I thought it was just Stewart until I met two other people from Fort Wayne.
I think what it is that Stewart goes out of his way to twist so many of his words, like the fact that he says Samurai and Meowster, that at that point I just assume he does any mispronunciations on purpose.
No, part of that is like it is actually a Fort Wayne drawl.
Okay.
I would like to thank the podcast listeners for being enough of a dick to point out my mispronunciation.
I don't
want to
come back on this thing if this is the
level
of fan reception. Yeah, I don't. I wish we hadn't said my name in the beginning.
Are there any other letters?
There are, but let's save the last one for next time because we're running long and just get straight to recommendations of movies that we saw that we might want to point people to instead of Trespass. But
like a movie compass.
We got a lot of joy out of Trespass.
It's not a bad movie. It's just a bad movie. I mean, it's not it wouldn't be the worst choice to just watch with some friends on a
That's true.
On a winter night.
That's very true. Winter night.
I mean, not a romantic winter. Yeah,
you're snowed in at a cabin.
You have the Movies with Friends app.
This is a good thing to watch with your friends. They'll get caught up in the story while you are planning how to murder and eat them.
Yeah.
Because you don't have enough food in the cabin.
Yep.
Winter night.
Or if you just want to watch it with them on that winter's night. Like, whatever your range of motives are, this is a good movie to fulfill them.
Should I go first?
Sure.
I'm going to recommend two things. First, on February 1st, Wednesday night, I'm going to be showing my regular monthly movie screening series at 92 Wide Tribeca. We're showing Dead End with Humphrey Bogart, Sylvia Sidney, Joel McRae. It's a William Wyler movie produced by Samuel Goldwyn, screenplay by Lillian Hellman. All-star cast, and before and behind the camera, and the movie that introduced the world to the Dead End Kids. You might know them as the Bowery Boys. It's a really good old movie. Classic. No, it's a good movie. It's an old classic Hollywood drama, and very good, and I'll be showing that. I also saw recently a movie that I enjoyed, a comedy called The Good Fairy from the 30s that Preston Sturges wrote, and then actually I think William Wyler directed that too. And it wasn't an amazing movie, but it was a very delightful, you know, old style 30s comedy. Light like a soap bubble. Dan?
I don't know that I have one. I have to admit it.
Zubin?
I can't remember movies that I've seen recently. We talked about this on the subway here. I haven't had time. I've been watching television. I will say that I got HBO Go on my iPad, and I started watching Band of Brothers, which I didn't think I was going to like, because I feel like there was a whole slew of Greatest Generation bullshit that got thrown at us all at once.
Yeah, it really was. Way to invite
the negative letters.
But this is all prelude to say that I started watching it, and I'm really enjoying it. So that's not a movie, but it's a filmed thing that I have enjoyed recently.
Zubin, go.
I was actually talking about this earlier with Dan and Elliot about Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which I really enjoyed watching the movie version with Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman, you saw it with him?
I saw it with him. He was embarrassed to see himself on film, which I think is endearing. But he's, I was telling him, Gary, you're great in this.
And unfortunately, he just kept nudging you with his elbow going, here's a good part.
Yeah.
Watch
it really
this
distracted
part. This
me.
Is a good part.
It really distracted me. I saw it in the theaters, but I had seen the Alec Guinness miniseries beforehand. And I would recommend the miniseries and not the movie. There's a little twist. Watch the movie. Definitely watch the movie.
That is a trespass-level twist.
Watch the miniseries first if you haven't already seen the movie. I think you'll enjoy it a bit more. It's 6 hours, which... it's a British miniseries from the 70s. It's longer, but it delves more into the characters who might be the mole. And so the plot is much more richly rewarding, and the final reveal of the mole is much more rewarding when you know all the possible moles. The movie, I think, crams it a bit too much. I still think it should have gotten a Best Picture nomination over half of the ones that were revealed yesterday, easily.
You've been railing against particularly War Horse and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close getting a nomination over Tinker, Tailor.
Those were not Best Picture-worthy movies. Yeah, I think that it's all relative, and I think those, especially...
And the Oscars are also ludicrous and bunk, you know.
Yeah, you know, I every time I complain about the Oscars, I always think of that, and it never helps my...
Still gets
it never
mad.
Distills my... Yeah, never, yeah. It never, like, weakens my anger. It's just, it's ridiculous that people who supposedly do this for a living would be like, well, the help is... Certainly deserving of a whole night of fanfare.
Well, you have a deep well of rage, you know, like heading between like a veil of pleasantness.
I do. There's
and
a
you
lot
know how they
things.
Got that? Well, fracking.
A lot of fracking.
It's really like, it's not going to help us, guys.
No,
like,
in the long run, it's doing more damage.
Really
than
inflated view. Like, we're not going to get 100 years of gas out of that.
Who knows what chemicals they pumped into Zubin to get that rage out of there?
I said the focus of this podcast would have shifted in the last 2 minutes. It's 58,
you're right,
58
we should
minutes
save this.
Of movie discussion, two intense minutes of leftist activism.
We should save this for the frack cast. The frack house.
Which starts right now. Welcome to frack.
It's very disappointing. People think that it's a Battlestar Galactica fan cast.
But that's the Galact House.
The Galaga House is our classic video
Galaga
game
House.
Cast.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, Zubin, thank you so much for coming on. Hey, here's the thing. Anything you want to plug?
Oh,
Look quickly.
Yeah, sure. Well, no.
Faster.
No, there's nothing I want to plug. Okay. Sorry. No,
a real dead end.
Yeah, sorry.
It's a real waste of time.
It was kind of sprung on me. I have nothing going on right now that's worth anybody knowing about. So,
I mean, just Google Zubin Prang. It's spelled like
spelled
it sounds.
Yeah,
it's
spelled like it sounds.
Jew as in Zubin.
Yeah.
Look, go to IMDb. Look up The Daily Show. Go down the list of writers. Find the one that looks like it would be pronounced Zubin Prang.
It's a lot of work.
Google that.
Really,
and then
a lot
you'll
of work.
See things that
you just, you know, browse through. See
you'll see
happens.
Things you wish you hadn't
yeah.
seen.
Yeah.
But thanks for listening. And thanks again to everyone who came on and saw
thanks
the
for,
live show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh,
thanks
our
a lot.
Pleasure. Great. Nice work. Thank you. But yeah, thanks for everyone who came to the live show and for everyone who listened tonight. Today to now.
And a big thank you to our fans.
Again,
not your fans. It's
very presumptuous. But for the Flophouse, I've been Dan McCoy.
I will continue to be Elliot Kalin, or will I?
And I'm Zubin Prang. Guest.
Good night, everyone.
All right, let's get this flop show on the flop road. Flop. We say flop a lot.
Oh, okay. Is that what I just got to throw that word in as much as possible?
Yeah, if possible. It's like how in space they use space for everything. Yeah.